Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
Criticism.
I just had to call in to respond to this week's installment of Never Trump Drivel from Terry Mattingly.
Compliments.
I love the interviews and insights because they help me battle the slings and arrows of outrageous theology in practice.
Clarification.
Is there a point where, without baptism, infants go to heaven, and after which time they go to hell if they're not baptized?
The Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382.
We're about to go into a dark winter, and he has no clear plan, and there's no prospect that there's going to be a vaccine available for the majority of the American people before the middle of next year.
And I say we're learning to live with it. We have no choice. We can't lock ourselves up in a basement like Joe does. He has the he has the ability to lock himself up.
He says that we're learning to live with it. People are learning to die with it.
Would you close down the oil industry?
By the way, I would transition from the oil industry, yes.
Oh,
I will transition.
That's a big step.
It has to be replaced by renewable energy over time. And I'd stop giving to the oil industry. I'd stop giving them federal subsidies.
That's maybe the biggest statement in terms of business. That's the biggest statement.
Okay.
Because basically what he's saying is he is going to destroy the oil industry. You keep talking about all these things you're going to do and you're going to do this. But you were there just a short time ago, and you guys did nothing.
We did.
You know, Joe, I ran because of you. I ran because of Barack Obama, because you did a poor job. If I thought you did a good job, I would have never run. I ran because of you. I'm looking at you now. You're a politician. I ran because of you.
You know who I am. You know who he is. You know his character. You know my character. The character of the country is on the ballot. Our characters in the ballot. Look at us closely.
Those are some excerpts from Thursday's final presidential debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden. So, what picture did Joe Biden want to paint of President Trump and vice versa? What picture did President Trump want to paint for the viewers of Joe Biden? Joe Biden is, by all reports, outraising and outspending President Trump by a huge margin. How important is that in the final days before the election? Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the new studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about that final presidential debate with Mark and Molly Hemingway. Then a little bit later in the hour, we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. You can vote for Soundbite of the Week by going to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. You can send your vote via Twitter at issuesetc, email talkback@issuesetc.org, or wait and give us a call when we play Soundbite of the Week, 1-877-623-MYIE. Joining us to talk about the final presidential debate, Mark Hemingway. He's senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And Molly Hemingway, a Fox News contributor. Molly, welcome.
Great to be here with you.
Molly, how would you compare and contrast Thursday's debate with the first presidential debate?
Well, the Thursday debate, the second debate, was much less raucous than the first debate. You could hear what each candidate believed about different issues, and so it had the effect of being more substantive. It was also probably a little more boring than the first debate. But it was a good debate, and you could really get a feel for how the two candidates differed in their policy positions.
What did you think about the contrast, Mark?
It was a marked contrast between both the first debate and the candidates themselves. I think that Trump was a lot more lucid, obviously, than the first debate, and he certainly was a lot calmer. And I think that that resonated very well. You got to remember, Trump is a man who sort of made his career through TV. So I think maybe he watched some tape of the first debate and remembered that television's kind of a cool medium and brought it down. At the same time, you know, there were ways that I felt that Joe Biden had a command of the facts in the first debate that he didn't really have in the second debate. Joe Biden seemed to score a lot of points on the COVID issue in the first debate. And honestly, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I thought that maybe on points, Trump actually won the COVID exchange, which, you know, is an issue he's in a very difficult place on, and having actually to be responsible for decisions he's made, as opposed to, you know, complaining about it from the outside like Joe Biden. So it was definitely interesting to see how much the debates have changed.
Molly, was there a clear winner last night?
I usually don't think of debates in terms of clear winners and losers, but this was a very strong debate for Donald Trump. It was very good for him tonally. I think a lot of people care about that tone issue, and he was very even-tempered and whatnot. His vision for the country was very optimistic compared to Joe Biden's very pessimistic and dark vision. He actually had a line about, like, this is the winter of our discontent or something. Like, we're headed for a very dark winter. There was a big contrast there. But the reason why I thought Trump won wasn't even because of his performance, although he did very, very well, and he was very effective at not forgetting to mention things at the right time, you know, take advantage of all the opportunities that Joe Biden gave him, but was really because of Joe Biden's answer to Donald Trump's question of whether he planned to end the oil industry. And I don't know what Joe Biden was thinking, but he said, yeah, absolutely, I want to end the oil industry. And he's got tight races, namely in Pennsylvania, but throughout the Rust Belt, where a lot of jobs depend on the oil industry. And Joe Biden was trying to say that he wants to phase out and, like, move away from fossil fuels. But a lot of Americans know that when large corporations plan to move things overseas or to change industries or companies, that it might benefit the people at the top, the elites, but it's usually pretty bad for the workers. And since the workers are the votes that you're trying to get, it was, even with all the nuance and explanation that Joe Biden tried to provide, I think it was just a tremendous unforced error. And I have no idea why he thought that was a good answer. But Donald Trump knew that. He just kept saying, did you guys all hear what this guy just said? You know, did you hear this in Pennsylvania? Did you hear this in Ohio? Did you hear this in Texas? And that is not going to do him any favors with voters there, what Biden said.
What are your thoughts on winners and losers last night, Mark?
I think it's pretty clear that Trump won the debate, both in terms of exceeding expectations that have been set for him after the first debate, but also just, you know, as Molly pointed out, I mean, on substance, in so many ways, he was much more lucid than Biden was. The oil thing was a, you know, gigantic misstep. He successfully, you know, brought up the issue of fracking in such a way that the Biden campaign tied into the furor over the oil issue in a way that I think hurt the Biden campaign, particularly in Pennsylvania. And further, Biden's clarification, he'd been trying to sort of have it both ways on fracking, you know, which is a key issue for Pennsylvania and Ohio and other swing states. He'd been trying to have it both ways, or was trying to get credit from the environmental groups and trying to appease, you know, environmentalists in the Democratic Party by saying that, you know, he's going to split the difference. And last night he clarified that he only wants to ban fracking on public lands. Well, if you know how much fracking occurs on public lands, and frankly, just how much of this country is publicly owned in terms of the land that's available to, you know, drill for oil, that would still, I think, kill a million jobs and shave something like $700 billion off the GDP in this country. I mean, it's a massive unforced error for him to be having to go out there and say this stuff publicly, and the press has kind of been letting Joe Biden get away with it. And, you know, there was an issue where Trump effectively called him on it. Similarly, I mean, I do think that, I think Trump could have done a little better job bringing up the Hunter Biden stuff, but he still managed to bring it up at a critical time when a lot of the story was breaking, and there's been a lot of attention focused on social media companies censoring the story in a way that's pretty, you know, unjust. So I think that Trump was able to shove a lot of issues about Joe Biden's positions out into the limelight and his, you know, own personal issues in a way that's going to make it harder for people to ignore. But, you know, we're so close to the election. The momentum, you know, certainly is going to help Trump. But the question is it enough to, you know, at this late a date to, you know, drag Trump over the finish line? And I think the jury's still out on that.
Molly, what did President Trump want viewers to believe about Vice President Biden last night?
I think that he wanted people to think that Joe Biden wasn't strong enough to be president, that he was weak, that he was liberal, and that he was compromised. And he did a better job of making viewers think that this time than at the previous debate, I will admit. Joe Biden struggled, particularly at the end. He just seemed frail. He seemed to be actually like worried about whether he could make it through. He was checking his watch at one point. He articulated positions that were very different from Donald Trump in a way that I think Donald Trump was pleased with. And then the number one campaign theme of the Biden campaign, it's not really so much based on policy. It's really this idea that Joe Biden has impeccable moral character and that Donald Trump does not. And that was a pretty big win for Donald Trump last night by being able to articulate that Joe Biden is part of a family that has benefited financially from their proximity to Joe Biden's power, and that they have done this by working with foreign entities, everyone from the wife of the mayor of Moscow to corrupt Chinese corporations that are in bed with the Chinese Communist Party. And so if your only reason really is to vote for Joe Biden because supposedly he's of this impeccable moral character and has never done the things he's done, you know, with destroying conservative judicial candidates or his plagiarism or lying or whatnot in that is pervasive throughout his career, you were reminded that it's not like you're going to get some clean situation if you vote for Joe Biden, that this will be something that you'll have to deal with if he's elected president. And that has got to have been exactly what the Trump campaign wanted to do.
Mark, what did Trump want the narrative to be about his opponent?
I think Molly was right in terms of, you know, what she identified about Trump wanting to label Joe Biden as not just this business as usual politician, but corrupt, but and at the same time show that part of the problem is, and part of the reason why people voted for Trump in the first place, is that mainstream American politics and, you know, so many mainstream American politicians were themselves obviously corrupt and trying to be very sort of, you know, high-minded at the same time. Whereas Trump's appeal, sort of ironically enough, was, hey, look, I'm totally transparent. I've had to cut deals with the mob to, you know, get buildings built. And I've had to write the checks to politicians to make sure stuff gets done because I know how corrupt the system is. And, you know, Molly's right that Joe Biden has run this very high-toned campaign on restoring honesty and integrity to the White House, when anyone who's actually been paying attention to Joe Biden and his career over a span of decades knows that that's just not the case. I mean, his brother Jim ran a lobbying shop in the 1990s that was essentially selling Joe's votes in the Senate to, you know, slimy class action lawyers. I mean, this has been going on for a very, very long time. And it's kind of a testament to how sort of both, I think, corrupt the media establishment is in terms of, you know, how they want to put forward this narrative about Democrats in particular and the system in Washington, and more generally, you know, being above reproach, but also just the fact that we need to know what's really going on here. Like I said, Trump's an open book. Biden, you know, has been around long enough. We should all know about all this stuff, but, you know, no one's reporting on it.
So, Molly, what did Vice President Biden want viewers to believe about the president?
I think the entirety of the Biden campaign could be summed up as orange man bad. That is the one unifying theme that you have seen throughout the entire campaign. The Democratic National Convention was about saying that the Donald Trump is a bad person, and that's the reason why Joe Biden claims that he ran this time for president, was because Donald Trump is bad. And so this was not as effective of a campaign event for Joe Biden because it just didn't come through at all. Donald Trump was very calm. You know, at the first debate, he could kind of say, aren't you tired of this guy? And last night, nobody was tired of Donald Trump. You know, he just was particularly calm version of himself and sober and whatnot. And compared to what Donald Trump was doing, which is saying this guy has been in government for 50 years and he claims that now, finally, he's going to do something, even though he didn't do it for the previous 50 years, it just made a lot of whatever attempts Joe Biden had made to convey his campaign theme, they kind of fell flat.
Mark, the Biden campaign has raised a record-breaking $761 million and almost $500 million of it in the last 2 months alone. And it's being reported that the Trump campaign is short on funds, even though he has tens of millions of dollars there. And he's outspending the president. How important is that in the final days before the election?
Well, it's certainly a factor. And, you know, without knowing how the Biden campaign is spending its money versus how the Trump campaign is spending its money, it's very hard to say whether that financial advantage is going to matter. A lot of what goes on in campaigns in the area of digital technology in terms of voter targeting stuff is kind of a, you know, amounts to sort of a secret sauce inside each campaign in terms of how they're able to identify the voters they most need to persuade and or identify the voters in their base that they need to motivate. So, you know, for instance, in 2016, Hillary Clinton outspent Trump 2-1. You know, and Hillary Clinton made campaign finance reform a huge theme of her campaign, crusading against Citizens United, you know, which was the Supreme Court decision that, you know, sort of blew out a lot of existing campaign finance laws. It's also worth mentioning that that case was literally about whether or not it was a campaign finance violation to show a film critical of Hillary Clinton. So, you know, not only was Hillary Clinton, you know, massively hypocritical in terms of campaign finance stuff, Donald Trump ended up being the greatest argument against money in politics. You know, he took down one of the most established politicians in the country who outspent him 2-1. You know, it's clear in this environment that, you know, money does not necessarily, you know, mean you're going to be swiftly carried into office just because you've raised more cash than your opponent.
Molly, how important is spending in the final days before the voters actually go to the polls?
Traditionally, it's extremely important. This cycle and last cycle, there was this very outlandish Trump supporter 4 years ago who said, the ground game is in the heart of Trump supporters. And so they didn't need the money that you normally require to like drag people to the polls to vote for a Romney or a McCain. People were just motivated and enthused on their own. So you need money to do advertising, need money to drive, get out the vote. And so it all depends on what the situation is with the actual voters that the Trump campaign can get. But it really has been a remarkable amount of money that the Biden campaign has put together. And I think it does show just how much sort of large corporate elites really care about this election and how they very much would like to have things go back to the old order where they have a little bit more say in the direction of the country.
Molly Hemingway is our guest. She's a Fox News contributor, and Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. We're talking about the final presidential debate. What did they make of the moderator? We'll answer that question next.
Criticism.
I just had to call in to respond to this week's installment of Never Trump drivel from Terry Mattingly.
Compliments.
I love the interviews and insights because they help me battle the slings and arrows of outrageous theology in practice.
Clarification.
Is there a point where without baptism, infants go to heaven and after which time they go to hell if they're not baptized?
The Issues Etc. Comment Line, 618-223-8382.
This is a message for pastors and lay leaders of Missouri Synod congregations. As we enter the last quarter of 2020, how are you doing and how's your church doing? What has the COVID lockdown done to your attendance and giving? In 25% of our churches, giving's actually gone up. So why are some churches struggling and others thriving? Here at LCMS Stewardship and the whole Office of National Mission team, we have answers and we have help for you and your church today. LCMS.org/stewardship.
Lutheranism in the public square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Since 1978, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries and her workers. Thanks to faithful investors, LCEF has provided thousands of church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations with the low-cost loans and resources they need to reach more people with the saving name of Christ. To learn more, visit lcef.org or call 800-843-5233, 800-843-5233.
Many educational institutions are governed by the whims of culture and are increasingly hostile to the Word of God. In contrast, Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, provides classical Lutheran education rooted in God's Word for students preschool through grade 12. Simply put, we equip students to stand firm in the faith through solid education focused on wisdom and virtue. We offer in-person instruction as well as live online classes for remote learning. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.
When it comes to children who don't have the wherewithal to determine their own bedtimes, their own sugar intake, no, children absolutely have a right to have their bodies protected.
On any given Sunday, after the 35 to 40 minute rock and roll smoke and light show concert in the dark, then you're going to have a 30 to 50 minute self-help presentation where verses and concepts from scripture are ripped out of their context.
But we have to pretend in all of these ways, because what we really want is what we want. I don't want to have a kid. Of course, I've already engaged in unreality because I pretended that what I was doing was not the child-making thing.
I think that danger of the science alone of our modern culture, I think that idol has been attacked by COVID.
We hold an election Fridays on Issues Etc. We call it Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We got four sound bites we've collected from this week's audio. We listen, we collect them, and then on Fridays we play them, and you get to decide which is soundbite of the week. The listener with the best vote gets the LPR bundle package. That's an I Have Issues t-shirt, an Ad Crucem pewter baptismal keepsake, the Issues Etc. pen, bumper sticker, notepad, and tote bag. The candidates this week are Katie Faust, Do Children Have the Right to Gender Transition?, Pastor Chris Roseborough, What Replaces Law and Gospel Preaching and Teaching in Missional Churches?, Dr. Anthony Esselin, Abortion and the Lies of Unreality?, and Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, The Idol of Scientism. You vote by giving us a call, 1-877-623-6943. Sending us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Vote at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, or send us a tweet at issuesetc. In the meantime, we're talking about the final presidential debate. Mark and Molly Hemingway are our guests. Mark, what were your thoughts on debate moderator Kristen Welker?
I think the debate moderation last night was the best moderation I've seen at a presidential debate, basically since I can remember. Now, having said that, bear in mind that we are clearing a very, very low bar. Debate moderation in the last, 20 years or so has been notoriously bad, and it's always been a memorable part of the campaign in terms of how the moderators manage to mess up or insert themselves into debates. You know, famously, Candy Crowley interrupting Mitt Romney to haughtily correct him on an issue in which she was wrong in 2012. Chris Wallace's failure to do anything to maintain order in the first debate. I mean, you know, these have been big issues. So, all told, it was good. On the other hand, there was a lot of substantive stuff. I mean, you know, we just had the fourth Mideast peace deal announced this morning, where Sudan is normalizing relations with Israel. And yet we haven't had a single question at either debate on, well, foreign policy has been extremely limited. We haven't had a single question on Afghanistan in particular, which, mind you, is a war we've been fighting almost 19 years at this point in time. I mean, it's just absolutely astonishing that we didn't get more foreign policy questions. On top of that, you know, there was no questions about, say, the Mideast peace deals that, you know, I just mentioned. There's so much more that should have been covered. And you can talk about this in terms of limiting time and whatnot. But at the end of the day, there was just a lot of, I think, silly questions that were asked in the two debates that should have been shunted aside and focused more on substantive issues.
Molly, how do you think Kristen Welker did last night?
I think there are two issues with debate moderation. One is this particular moderator, and one is the Presidential Debate Commission. This particular moderator, it's a low bar, but she did better than the other moderators of recent note. I didn't like how she built into her questions the liberal assumption. She said something like, well, as we all know, the Supreme Court battle is really about health care. Well, no, we don't all know that. That's the Democrats' talking point. And so to beg the question that way in a question to presidential candidates is just offensive and exhausting. But she did less of that than a lot of other people do. So I don't want to give too much credit, but even having less of that is better. The Presidential Debate Commission itself is a train wreck, and this year was its worst year ever. They did a poor job of organizing debates. They refused, even though after they scheduled the debates, we had this like rush to do early voting with like tens of millions of people already having voted by now. They refused to move the debates up earlier in the cycle as the Trump campaign requested. They shouldn't have even needed a request, but they definitely should have done it. They had their second moderator have to drop out because he was caught like trying to figure out how to do something with regard to Trump by talking to one of Trump's enemies, and he was busted for it, and then he lied about it and claimed that he'd been hacked. That second debate got canceled. And so they really took away from the American people good opportunities to have interesting and important discussions about their two presidential candidates. And they need to
probably go away. But if they don't go away, they need to be radically and dramatically reformed.
Mark, are there traditional Republican states that are in play for the Biden campaign?
I would say yes. Arizona is certainly the big one in that regard. There are definitely polls showing that Biden is up in the state, and there is definitely a lot of attention focused on that. I don't think Republicans are helped by the fact that they have a Senate candidate in there that has been, struggled to get elected, and I think she was appointed to her seat currently, and she's not doing well in her race, too, so that's not helping them and sort of, get enthusiasm up in the state. You know, having said that, it is a traditional Republican state, and we could very well be surprised by how much better Trump does than the polls show. North Carolina is also a state that, the Biden campaign hopes to get. But that's been, a close purple state-ish, even though it's leaned Republican for a while now. The big white whales for Democrats, of course, are Texas and Georgia. They've been, agitating to flip those states for a long time, and lots of population influxes suggest that might happen at some point. Whether or not it's possible this year or not, I don't know.
Molly, are there traditional Democratic states that are in play for the Trump campaign?
Yeah, just if you're saying statistically who won, two out of the three last presidential elections, when those states went Democrat, Pennsylvania is the one that Obama won by 10 points and Trump eked out a very tiny victory last time around. Florida, Obama won both times. Trump eked out a victory there. Wisconsin, Obama won both times, and Trump narrowly eked out something. Also Michigan and Ohio, Obama won both of those states. Trump is currently up in Ohio, but he won it big in 2016. And Iowa, Obama won Iowa also both times, and Trump won it last time. So there are quite a few states. Those are the battleground states, really. And in addition to those states I mentioned are the ones that Mark mentioned as the place where you want to watch everything. So people pay a lot of attention to these national polls to determine who's going to win. But really, it's going to come down to if the Trump campaign can win Florida and Arizona and North Carolina. And that is a big if, particularly with, I'd say, North Carolina and Arizona, then all he has to do is win one of the Midwestern-ish Rust Belt states. So that's what the Trump campaign is trying to do.
Molly, listener Beth writes this: "We are confused. My husband said to get some good counsel, so I'm writing to you. We are getting mixed messages as to whether to vote early or go on November 3rd as we normally would." And she asks, what would Molly and Mark Hemingway do? Molly, how would you answer that question?
I think it somewhat depends on what state you're in. So first off, if you're comfortable going on election day, I strongly believe in election day voting. I think it's good for the people. It's good to have one day set aside for this. And also, you don't know what's going to happen prior to election day. You just had a great debate last night, and there were all these people who voted before the debate even happened. So I would be strongly biased in favor of election day voting, particularly if everything's lined up great for that in your state. I would say there are some states that have had long established mail-in balloting programs like Colorado and Oregon, and I'm not a huge fan of those, but they're pretty well established. If you're in one of those states, obviously you have to do mail-in balloting, but maybe don't do the ones where they've just rushed to do mail-in balloting. I would just worry that you wouldn't be confident that your vote was received and counted or not manipulated. But that's just my personal view. Do whatever is best for you, I would say.
Mark, what are your recommendations?
I mean, first and foremost, make sure you vote. I think that's sort of critical, and at the same time, follow up on your vote. A lot of states these days have a way to, if you use a mail ballot, to follow up and make sure you know what happened to your ballot. So do that if you have to vote by mail. But in general, there are so many problems with mail-in voting, and particularly this year, where it's been a longstanding goal of the Democratic Party to move everything over to, mail-in ballots and stuff like that. I think that there are huge problems with mail-in ballots. They did a study in my home state of Oregon where, gosh, I wish I could, recall more detail off the top of my head, but there was, an academic study done that showed some surprising percentage of Oregonians admitted that they had or knew of people that had voted using ballots for relatives or other people that came to their house. So, yeah, there's definitely some issues that come along with mail-in balloting. And I think we should not be legitimizing that process. It's leading to all kinds of like crazy court decisions. For instance, the 4-4 Supreme Court just basically upheld a Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision that allowed, even though it's very clear in state statute that you're not supposed to count mail ballots that don't arrive before 8 p.m. on election day, the court unilaterally basically wrote their own laws and extended the deadline 3 days. And not only that, the court said that any mail ballots that come in after election day that don't have postmarks or other proof that the ballots were cast before election day still have to be counted. So if Trump wins, you know, Pennsylvania in a squeaker by a few thousand votes, and all of a sudden, you know, big crates of votes with no postmarks start, you know, turning up in, you know, Philadelphia Wednesday morning, which is a city that has quite the history of voter fraud. There was a former Pennsylvania congressman that was just indicted in voter fraud charges earlier this year. So we've got to be very, very careful about legitimizing the mail ballot process too much. I realize a lot of people may not have, you know, even options in their state, or it's the most convenient thing, and you should do what you need to do to vote. But in general, we should be moving toward a situation here where as many people vote in person as humanly possible. I think one good way to do that would be to not necessarily have early voting, but just sort of extend the number of days that you can, you know, vote in person to, you know, 4 or 5 days in a certain week. I think that would alleviate a lot of the problems rather than having early voting, you know, 6 weeks in advance and, you know, mail ballots, you know, coming in 2 months in advance in some cases. We really just need to focus on getting as many people to vote in person in as short a window of time, if that's the way that you avoid the most corruption.
You can read Mark and Molly Hemingway's columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Mark Hemingway is senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and co-author of the book Justice on Trial. Molly, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, it's Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We're going to play our 4 soundbites for you. Then you get ready to vote. 1-877-623-MYIE. What's the relationship between the Book of Proverbs and the Ten Commandments? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Provoking Proverbs, Wisdom, and the Ten Commandments. It's a new 10-lesson Bible study produced by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or read an excerpt of Provoking Proverbs at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Provoking Proverbs, Wisdom, and the Ten Commandments. 1-800-325-3040.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Here at Elm Grove Evangelical Lutheran Church, you'll find folks just like you, sinners in need of what only Christ can give, the full forgiveness of all of our sins. In a world where change turns things upside down, we serve a Lord who never changes and who has promised to be with us always until the very end of the age. If you find yourself in the Milwaukee suburbs, look us up. Elm Grove Evangelical Lutheran Church is the only Lutheran church in Elm Grove, Wisconsin.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You may be one of those pastors who need to be refreshed and refueled because of your parish ministry.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Charles Geeshan.
Concordia Theological Seminary has a wonderful program, not only in continuing education during the summer, but in a advanced study program called the Doctor of Ministry. And it's a very practical program because it focuses on congregational ministry. It incorporates biblical theology with the ministry of the congregation. It's also very accessible for pastors, and it's also affordable. You can major in pastoral care and leadership, teaching and preaching, or mission and culture. And we pray that pastors will take advantage of this program.
Learn more about the Doctorate of Ministry program at ctsfw.edu or by calling 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.